we're still on the failure of atheism. And as Carlito said, we're going to be dealing with the problem of evil, but there was a couple other atheistic arguments I wanted us to look at. And, we covered Albert Camus' book, The Plague. And so we want to look at the arguments from contradictory attributes. Basically, these arguments run along these lines, where the atheists would say, okay, if God exists, the God that you claim exists has these two attributes, these two characteristics. Well, if we look closely at that, one characteristic contradicts the other one. So it's impossible for your kind of God to exist, okay? That's the line of reasoning that is given. An example is the first argument listed there. Just about everybody who's witnessed to an atheist has heard this at one time or another, but it argues as follows. An all-powerful God can do anything. Even create a rock that he cannot lift, but if he can't lift his rock, he's not all-powerful. Therefore, no all-powerful God exists. So saying, if God is all-powerful, he can do anything, including create a rock that he can't lift, but then if he can't lift it, he's not all-powerful, there's something he can't do. And so they try to show that even just the lone attribute of omnipotence, God being all-powerful, that alone in itself is a self-contradictory concept, they would argue.
It's like a misconception. You've seen that a lot.
Yeah, because right off the problem is right in number one, premise number one, all-powerful God can do anything. We Christians believe that God is all-powerful. But we, if we're thinking Christians, we don't define what being all-powerful means in such a way that it contains contradictory things. That, you know, being all-powerful means that God, that the God who can never be handcuffed could get handcuffed. You know, I mean, it's the way we define all-powerful is that God is able to accomplish anything that he desires. Yet even there, but basically God is able to accomplish anything that is logically possible. Yeah, can't contradict his nature. For instance, God's nature is good. So God can't lie, okay? God can't sin. But it also means that it can't be logically contradictory. For instance, God can't create square circles. Okay? It's impossible for him to exist. He can't create humans who are also non-humans. Okay? Basically, God is all-powerful, but there are things that even he can't do. He can't fail. He can't sin. See, basically what they're saying is, when you really spell out what this objection is, it's if God is all-powerful, he can do anything, including fail. No, he can't fail because he's all-powerful. Everything he sets out to do, he will be able to do. And he can't fail, he can't sin, he can't lie, he can't change his mind. He can't do anything which is impossible by nature. He can't create square circles. And so God can create a rock of tremendous size, but as the creator of that rock, he will always be able to master that rock. Now, Lucifer might think he's the one aspect of creation that God can't master, but Lucifer is wrong. God created him, God's going to have no problem mastering him. And so God will always be able to master his creation. So the problem there is that there's a faulty definition of omnipotence, God being all-powerful. Now the second argument is a little bit tougher than the first one, But I still don't think it's too difficult to answer. And this is an argument that goes way back to the time of the ancient philosophers. Either something is good because God wills it, okay? But then good would be arbitrary. Or God wills it because it is good, but then the good is above God. Therefore, either good is arbitrary or good is above God. But let me try to explain. God says, thou shalt not kill. Okay, now is God saying that killing is wrong? Is it like, you know, before he created the universe, did God say, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, okay, the eenies and the meenies are going to be good, and the minies and the moles are going to be wrong, okay? So that he just arbitrarily said, okay, killing is bad and hugging people is good. But if God wanted to, he could arbitrarily said hugging people is bad and killing people is good. So if something is good because God wills it, then torturing innocent people is really not evil. Because it's just arbitrary. God arbitrarily just decided. We have laws against murder, against assault, okay? But we also have some pretty arbitrary laws so that if two cars come to a four-way, come to a stop sign at a four-way intersection, and they come there at the same time, I forget if the car to the right has the right of way. That's arbitrary. It's not saying you are morally right and the other one's morally wrong. That's purely arbitrary, but we need some kind of arbitrary law there or they're both going to go and slam into each other. And if they do both slam into each other, somebody needs to get a ticket because somebody's got to be at fault. It's just the way our laws are set up. Are God's moral laws, are they that way? Are they just arbitrary or... are they, is it really wrong to murder? And that's why God says, thou shalt not murder. So, if it's just good because God wills it, then it's arbitrary. But then good isn't really good. Or maybe God wills it because it's good. But then if God wills it because it's good, that sounds like there's a moral law above God. Okay, a standard above God, but then God wouldn't be God. Okay? Now, the response is this, that God wills it because it is consistent with his own good nature. So the standard is not above God, nor is it arbitrary. There really is a standard. Good is really good. But the standard is not above God because God is the standard. That's why the scriptures say God is good. God is love. We have love, we have goodness, but God is goodness, God is love, and as the source of all love, he is love. As the source of all goodness, he is goodness. So there is a standard, this isn't arbitrary, but that standard flows from God's nature, from who God is. But since God is the standard, he is the ultimate. There's nothing above him. And so those are two common arguments that are used. Look, really, in scholarly circles, you'll find these types of arguments from contradictory attributes, but you won't find these arguments have been refuted, open, shut case. So they're looking for other ways to argue that God's attributes are contradictory. Michael Martin uses a few arguments. I didn't bring them in my book. He is a verse 18. Didn't they have a copy of it?
I have.
Okay. Because he uses some newer forms of that. And they're very, very weak. God is all knowing, then he would know how to swim. But the only way you could know how to swim is you have to have a body. And he just ignores the fact that there have been some really solid, that there's some solid philosophical argumentation that argues that not all knowledge is through experience. For instance, if you just suppose the possibility of an all-knowing being, then by definition, that all-knowing being, that omniscient being that knows everything, could not know things by experience. Because if it knows things by experience, it would have to experience them to learn them, and so it would be learning things. But an omniscient being is like, it has one thing in common with an absolute ignoramus, that they both can't learn anything. An omniscient ignoramus is incapable of learning. But an omniscient being can't learn something because then that would imply that it didn't know it before it learned it. And so God's knowledge is innate. In other words, God always existed and he always knew everything there was to know. And so basically, Michael Martin is equating knowledge with knowledge through experience. And that's not the way God knows. God doesn't know through experience. He just knows, period. He knows it innately. And so basically what I'm getting at, there are these types of arguments are still out there, but they've got some new twists to them. And in fact, 95% of refuting atheism and refuting of any other non-Christian worldviews is kind of decoding. You have to decode the supposed new argument to find out what old argument is disguised as this new argument. But it's the same old argument. Like Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. And it's like Paulie Little says in Know Why You Believe, you know, don't worry about it. Somebody's not going to develop an argument tomorrow that's going to refute Christianity. They've been trying them for 2,000 years. And every time somebody comes up with what they claim is a new argument, lo and behold, it's something that Augustine or Aquinas refuted hundreds of years ago. So, any questions about that? Or comments?
No, I'm just thinking that can't we fight presupposed good or as they reach final good there? What's the point in argument that it'd be that arbitrary real good?
Second
argument.
Yeah, well, a lot of
we just use the terminology to talk about that.
See, this, the thing is too, is you could have it, it's not Camus that's using this argument here. Or are you talking about Camus' argument?
The
cognitive attributes. Basically, this kind of argument can come from two types of quote unquote atheists. One would be more closer to pantheists, but either the atheists say, look, I really don't believe, look, it can really come from three types of atheists. One, an atheist who really believes in absolute moral laws, so really believes in good, a real objective good and a real objective evil, and just doesn't see that, how that contradicts his atheism. Okay, because if there's an absolute moral law, it's got to be an absolute moral lawgiver. But most atheists are more consistent, and they really deny the existence of good and evil. They can't live that way, can't live consistently with it, but they deny it. And so there they would be saying, I'm just using what you would call good, hypothetically, and, you know, on and on like that. And then there's another type who would deny the existence of a personal God, but would say, like Plato, the good exists. Like in Plato thought his God, Demiurgos, was lower than the good, the abstract, impersonal good. And so so you might have somebody that might be really be arguing more than against God, but actually for the good, some impersonal goodness that actually exists above what the Christians would call God. But now, Anthony Flew, it's really not Anthony, it's actually Anthony. I put an H in there and it shouldn't be there. Gary Habermas debated Anthony Flew on the resurrection question, but that he's one of the world's leading living philosophers in Great Britain. He's an atheist. And his parable on the invisible gardener is really, really interesting. I actually think he got it from John Wisdom, but he just took it a step or two further. The two guys walk into the wilderness, into this heavily wooded area and all, and it looks like nobody's been there before, you know. They walk into the woods and they see a clearing. They see this beautiful, beautiful flower, beautiful garden. And so the believer says, well, here you see evidence of design. Here you see flowers and all. So there's a beautiful garden, so there has to be an intelligent garden. And the non-believer says, no, 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 it's just like all those trees over there got here by chance. These flowers got here by chance. And there is no garden. So they argue back and forth, and then they decide, well, wait a minute. Let's camp out and we'll wait to see if the gardener shows up. Okay, so they camp out and they wait. And a few days go by, the gardener doesn't show up. So the atheist, the non-believer, says, well, therefore the gardener doesn't exist. So the believer says, well, maybe he exists, but he's invisible. So the atheist says, well, fine, let's build a fence around the garden. And we'll get bloodhounds, and we'll make it one of these electrical fences where the gardener will hear him scream when he gets zapped and that type of thing. But days go by, the bloodhounds don't alert. You know, they don't hear any zapping from the electrical fence, any screaming and stuff. So the atheist says, well, therefore that proves it. The invisible gardener doesn't exist. And the believer says, well, the invisible gardener exists, but not only is the invisible gardener invisible, but is also not detectable by any other senses as well. And so then the atheist says, okay, well then what's the difference between your invisible gardener and no gardener at all? Okay? Now, I have to admit, when I first read that, that sounded pretty, it sounded pretty strong. Whoa, man, that's what, but you see, the card deck is loaded. The deck of cards is loaded on the side of the atheist from the start. Because what is this guy saying from the outset in this? In his power. There's only one kind of evidence to accept. Evidence of the five senses. So if you have an invisible God, a spiritual God, the only way you can prove his existence is from the effects of this God. So right away the deck is stacked against him. What it's basically saying is, I refuse to accept any evidence unless I refuse to accept the existence of anything unless it can be proven through the five senses. What are we right back at? It's basically, if you just yeah. The old look at A.J. Ayers on page 3, logical positivism. It's the old verification principle disguised just 50 years later, where truth can only be found through the five senses. And of course the verification principle says that either something is true by definition or it can only be found through the five senses. And now, since God can't be proven through the five senses, not true by definition, supposedly, therefore he doesn't exist. What was the problem with the verification principle?
Can't verify itself.
Right, right. It fails its own test for truth. It can't verify itself. So, that's number one. One of my old professors, Terry L. Meathy, he used to teach at Liberty, now he's teaching over at Oxford, but in a book where he had a book debate with Anthony Flew, he kept slamming Flew saying, this, you're resurrecting the old verification principle here. So And see, what Flew is saying, he's not, he's trying to come at it from the other side. Instead of saying, in order to verify something, you've got to verify, be able to verify it through the five senses. He's saying, in order to falsify, in order for something to be meaningful, there has to at least be the logical possibility of falsifying. In other words, if I say Carlito's here today, tonight, then for that statement to be meaningful, there have to be ways that we would be able to falsify that statement if it wasn't true. So, okay, Matthew walks in downstairs and he sees me and he says, is Carlito here? And I say, yes, Carlito is here. He's upstairs. Okay? So then Matthew walks up there and doesn't see Carlito. And then I come upstairs and he says, you told me Carlito was up here and he's not here. Maybe he left. And I said, no, he didn't leave. And he is up here. And the man said, well, he's not up here. Yeah, he is, but he's invisible. Okay? So you see where Anthony Flew is trying to go with it. But the fact of the matter is, there are ways. This argument actually would be strong, a strong argument against the God of the New Age movement.
Yeah, it sounds like
how do you know God exists? And the guy says, well, because I needed money and I was hurting and I prayed, and the next day I got a check in the mail. And then 3 weeks later, how do you know God exists? Well, because I'm suffering, and in my suffering I realize a sense of need for a greater being, and so I, so when things go wrong with you, that's evidence for God's existence. When things go good for you, that's evidence for God's existence. No matter what way you look at it, natural laws, the universe operates in an orderly fashion, that's evidence for God's existence. But when those natural laws are superseded and something occurs that goes against those natural laws, like a miracle, a raising of someone from the dead, that's evidence for God's existence. So Anthony Flew's saying you're stacking the deck. No matter what side you come from, you see everything as evidence for God's existence. But in reality, it's the atheist who's stacking the deck. Although I would argue some of those arguments that I went over are good arguments for God's existence. Some are pretty lousy arguments for God's existence. But the fact of the matter is, if we have a God who has never revealed, an invisible God who has never revealed himself in the physical world, then Flew's argument would work. It wouldn't disprove the existence of God, but it certainly would basically present a good argument that this God has given no evidence to us for his existence, so why should we even believe him? I mean, the universe, if God didn't reveal himself in the physical world, then a physical world without God would look no different than a physical world with God. Okay? And once you phrase Anthony Flew's invisible gardener argument that way, immediately what comes to mind is that, well, wait a minute, though. This does not look like the physical world would be if there was no God. Because if there was no God, if there was no God, could there even be a physical universe? That's the cosmological argument. Number two, if there was no God, could there be design in this physical universe? Number three, if there was no God, would there really be such things as moral laws? Would life really be meaningful? And so basically what we're getting at is, there are evidences for God's existence apart from the world of the senses. But even in the world of the senses, it's the existence of the world is evidence for God's existence, not a design. But even when you get beyond that, the fact that God has revealed himself in a supernatural way, Flew's argument fails to admit the possibility of fulfilled prophecies, eyewitness miracles, and the resurrection. In other words, for instance, the incarnation of Christ, okay? Well, in Christianity, the invisible gardener has become visible. So, right there, God revealed himself by becoming a man and performing miracles and that eyewitness testified to. You know, see, it's Flew who's got the double standard. Because Flew is the one who said, well, I'll accept eyewitness testimony so long as it doesn't contradict any of my philosophical beliefs. 500 eyewitnesses who saw Jesus risen from the dead doesn't say anything to Flew. One witness who said, yeah, you just go down two blocks, take a right, and McDonald's comes up on the left side, that's enough evidence for Flew to act on it. And you know, so basically, as long as it's not the supernatural, so he's rejecting the supernatural at the outset, but whatever the case, the God of the Bible not only created the physical world, but we need to wake Anthony Flew up and say, look, we are not deists. We're not saying God created the world and left it alone. Christianity argues that God reveals himself in many different ways, some of them through the miracles that he performed that were eyewitnesses to those miracles. He also wrote us a book, the Bible. And so basically, the invisible gardener has made himself known. And not just through creation, but also not just through natural revelation, but through supernatural revelation as well. And so basically, we could argue, no, there's, you know, we've got more than just, you know, if you just argue just from the invisible gardener, okay, if you're really arguing from the Christian standpoint, not only is the garden so well designed that alone is evidence and not for the invisible gardener. But in Christianity, that invisible gardener has become visible. And so we actually, you know, have eyewitness accounts that he did walk the earth, and he did rise from the dead, and he did raise people from the dead. Now, if you look at AP6, we'll get back to the problem of evil. In just a minute, but the absurdity of life without God, it's actually an argument for God's existence as well as an argument against atheism. But if God does not exist, and there's no life after death, okay, no rewards or punishments, then it's hard to see, and there's no such thing as right and wrong. No defeat of evil, because really, even when innocent babies suffer, that's really not a product of evil, because there really is no such thing as evil. It's hard to see how life could have any meaning that way. If there's no God and there's no life after death, no punishments, no rewards, it's hard to see why it would make any difference whether you lived your life like Corey Ten Boom and protected innocent Jewish people, or if you lived your life like Adolf Hitler and slaughtered innocent Jewish people. A million years from now, you would have ceased to exist. Everyone that you've ever influenced will have ceased to exist. A billion years from now, probably the whole human race will have ceased to exist. What's the big deal whether you live 70 years slaughtering people or 70 years treating people with kindness? In fact, what even makes people valuable? If there's no God, if we were not created by God in His image, what gives value to human life? I mean, all we are would be mere molecules in motion. And, you know, if Carlito got upset and walked outside and kicked a mound of dirt. You know, John would say, oh, let me call the police. Get the police here. You assaulted a mound of dirt. But the fact of the matter is, you know, our chemical composition isn't much different than that mound of dirt. And in fact, you know, and so it's, you know, what gives meaning to life? So if there is no God, then life is absurd and without meaning. When everything's said and done, the real problem with atheists is not intellectual. It's not the mind. Okay? So all this intellectual stuff, now someone might be intellectually led astray, but ultimately you can trace these arguments back to guys who are trying to build an intellectual smokescreen, because it's not really an intellectual problem, it's a moral problem. It's a problem of the will. I don't want to bow before God, therefore I argue that he doesn't exist. Now, does that mean that we just ignore the intellectual stumbling blocks? No, we've got to try to remove those to help people see. But you could basically prove the existence in the Aquinas point is that you could prove to someone that God exists, but that doesn't mean that that person is going to believe in the God who exists. So they can still choose by an act of the will. Say, well, I don't want him to exist. I'm going to pretend that he doesn't exist. I think this stems from man's two greatest drives. It's kind of like the essence of free will. We have a drive within us for transcendence. To transcend this world of experience, the world of the senses, to search for something more. You know, Mike Tyson wants to be the heavyweight champion of the world, and finally when he becomes the king of the hill, he finds out it's not all perked up to be. Next thing you know, he's in prison. There's always, you know, we're always trying to get something. You know, we think if we get this lifelong goal, then we'll be happy. And for most people, what keeps them semi-happy is that they haven't achieved that goal. Once they achieve it, then they find out it's not all it perked up to be, and all of a sudden they're not happy anymore. But well, it's basically what God put in our hearts, that thirst for him. And granted, most people try to satisfy that, quench that thirst with something other than God. The Bible calls that idolatry. But there's this drive for transcendence, but there's also this drive for autonomy. We desire to be our own king, to be our own God. And so we have to choose, should I give in to this thirst for God and seek God, or should I choose to be my own king and ignore the fact that God exists? And the atheist falls on the autonomous side. He wants to be his own king. And so he rejects God. Now, look at Romans chapter 1. Romans chapter 1 and verses 18 to 22. Romans 1, verses 18 to 22. And Matthew, if you could read that.
For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them. For God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse.
Okay, the next two verses.
For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools.
Okay. Yeah, and now if you look at that, does this passage say that the atheist doesn't know that God exists?
No.
No, it says he had no excuse because he does know that God exists. You can't suppress a truth that you do not know. Okay? Now, I'm not saying that an atheist would fail a lie detector test when he says there is no God. Because we are most successful at our lying when we lie to ourselves. That's why Jeremiah says that the heart is deceitful above all things. Who could know it? So, you know, it's just like every time you sin, and every time I sin, it comes with a built-in excuse so that I justify, oh yeah, the reason why I blew my temper was it was righteous anger and I was standing up for God's kingdom. And what we have to do at that moment is ignore that voice, make it an excuse for our sinfulness and admit, no, I did sin and now I need to apologize to these people. But if you choose to accept that lie, no matter how dumb it may be, it is very easy. You know, so every time you sin, it comes with a built-in lie that you are willing to accept at times. The difficult thing is to get others to believe that lie. You know, well, the reason why I did it was such and such. Like, no. You were wrong. You didn't have a good reason for doing what you did. But with us, it's just so easy for us to lie to ourselves and to put out that the voice of our conscience telling us when we're wrong, convicting us. Yeah. And I think it's the same with the belief in God. The atheist can suppress that truth to the point where I think he can pass a lie detector test, that he can convince himself that lie is true. But the fact of the matter is, deep down inside, the atheist knows that God exists because God says that those who reject the existence of the Creator God suppress that truth, and you can't suppress a truth that you don't already know. And that's why God says that they're without excuse. They can profess to be wise all they want. And by the way, you know, my grandson is 3 years old and about to turn 4. If he walked in this room right now and he called me Dada or he pointed at that black punching bag, okay, and he said, look Dada, there's a black punching bag, okay, would you go home and tell your parents and say, Dr. Fernandez's grandson is the most brilliant 3-year-old I've ever met in my life because there was a black punching bag that he pointed at and said, look, there is a black punching bag. Even a 3-year-old knows when he's looking at a black punching bag that it's a black punching bag. Okay, you don't say, well, that's the wisest guy on planet Earth. Okay? However, if a philosophy professor walked up with you to that black punching bag, pointed at it,
black kidney bag,
and gave you 2 hours worth of argumentation that almost convinced you that that black punching bag didn't even exist, okay? See what I'm getting at is, it doesn't take a kindergarten education to acknowledge the obvious. But it does take about a PhD worth of education to be able to explain away the obvious. Okay, I mean, we've got moral value, and I'm using figurative language here, we've got moral value bouncing off our heads. We got meaning in life bouncing off our heads. We're tripping over eternal truths. We see design all over this universe. I mean, so what I'm getting at is evidence for God's existence all around, and even a baby sees that. But when you want to reject that, that's why Paul says we have no excuse for rejecting. But when you want to reject and deny the obvious truth of God's existence, yes, then you have to be broken. So I don't think that the 80-year-old grandma who believes that God exists because the Bible tells her so and doesn't have a cosmological argument with four premises and a conclusion, I don't think she needs to apologize because she has the simple faith. Maybe she just can't put it into words. The fact of the matter is, it does take a whole lot of false wisdom and speculation to argue against the opposite. There are good philosophers who can make you question the existence. But that bunch of them, they can say, how do you know that there's a bunch of them? Well, I can feel it, I can see it, blah, 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 all those other stuff. So, do you really have that punching bag in your head? Well, no, I don't have that punching bag in my head. It's out there. Well, what do you have in your head? What goes through your brain and all
that? I don't see it.
Yeah. But the thing is, you're going to end up doing it in a cancer dilemma. You're going to be saying, well, I have an idea of that punching bag. Well, how do you know your idea of that punching bag is really reliable, so that there really is a punching bag there? You only know the punching bag as it appears to you, not the punching bag as it is. And then, you know, the punching bag appears to be pretty solid to you, doesn't it? Well, let's examine it under a microscope. Take a closer look. There's more empty space than there is. So, you know, with a certain amount of sophistication and speculation, you can start making a quote-unquote, you know, a false wisdom, quote-unquote, plausible case for the totally irrational. And that's what Paul's getting at, is these guys profess to be wise, but they become fools. And so mankind, basically, we don't want to bow before God. So it only makes sense that a higher percentage of educated people would reject God than non-educated, than the percentage of non-educated people, because it takes a lot of education to deny the existence of the obvious. But when you recognize that it's a moral problem and not an intellectual problem, you see the intellectual aspects coming on the side. One of the Huxleys actually admitted that his problem wasn't with God, his problem was with traditional morality. But he realized if he wanted to do his own thing, that he would have to remove the fear of hell from himself. And the only way to do that was to try to look for evidence to disprove God. So one of the Huxleys was actually so honest that he admitted that his first problem wasn't a philosophical problem with God. His first problem was a moral problem. He wanted to do his own thing, but to do his own thing and feel comfortable, he would have to believe that God doesn't exist, so then he started arguing in that direction. Most atheists are not that honest. In fact, most of us are not that honest about our presuppositions and all. But the problem here, Paul is saying, the problem is not an intellectual one. They have knowledge of God because God gave them the knowledge of himself. The problem is a moral one, the choice. They choose to reject the true God.
Oh, and that's your thing. Someone accepts that God is there, they get it wrong. You know, they try to change it into their own thing.
Yeah.
And it gets you worse. Yeah, you get the punching bag there, but I don't have to punch it.
The way Isaiah put it is God who came lately. And then Isaiah sounds like a Freudian psychologist when he talks about, gods of their own imagination. He talks about the fact that the false gods were made by the wishful thinking of people. But the problem with Freud's argument is No one would wish for the demands of God to provide. I mean, are you really going to wish for a God that if you don't get with his program, you spend eternity in torment? Are you really going to invent a God that says, thou shalt not, to things that, you know, there's always some kind of sin that's appealing to even Christians. And so if we're going to make and invent a God of our own wishful thinking, it's going to be a God after our image. I think the ultimate wishful thinking God is the God of the New Age, where you can look in the mirror and say, oh, there he is, there's my God. And then you can just do whatever you please. Take a look at John 3.